You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Katoa, ko Joel toku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mo tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Max. E whai akane coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the recent study showing the increased speed of Antarctic ice melt, the removal of the Proud Boys designation as a terrorist group, and the government's recent family boost announcement. For this week's Get Action, Wednesday Wire host Otto spoke with Dave McPherson from Save Our Trains Southern about a petition of his calling for the restoration of the Southerner train line. And Otto spoke with co-head of Māori and Pacific Studies at the University of Auckland, Gordon Nano, about French President Emmanuel Macron's proposal to grant New Caledonia associated statehood. On Monday, producer Samantha spoke to the Deputy Director Māori at the Centre of Brain Research, Te Huinga Hinengaro, about her kaupapa to support rural Māori communities with members suffering from mate wareware or dementia. Max, what do you have for us today?
I spoke with PSA National Secretary Fleur Fitzsimons to talk about the historic strike that is occurring at Pharmac this week.
Hey aho whakaaro, we would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text in on 5395. Kaua e wareware, e ahei ana koto, te whakarongo ki e nei kōrero anō, hei pakihiri rokiroki mā rongi i te pai, tukutuku o Irirangi Pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
Recently, a study was conducted by researchers at the University of Southampton, which uncovered a shift in the circulation of the Southern Ocean. The study showed that the shift would draw up more salt water from the deep ocean, subsequently accelerating the loss of ice in the Antarctic and leading to an increase of sea levels and global heating. The week before, the government allowed the terrorist designation given to the far-right Proud Boys group to expire, effectively decriminalising the act of funding or supporting or openly supporting the group here in Aotearoa. And just yesterday, Finance Minister Nicola Willis confirmed a number of changes to Family Boost, which she said would help families with the cost of living. For a weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March to get the party's take on all of these issues. What was the Green Party's reaction to the University of Southampton study showing that Antarctic ice was melting at an increased speed?
It just shows that the ongoing failure by governments across the world, including our one, to take climate change seriously, is leading to catastrophic consequences for the livelihoods of many people, particularly those near low-lying areas that are already experiencing floods. And we need a government that, instead of, for example, investing hundreds of millions into fossil fuels, is actually investing in things like clean energy, fast speed rail, and energy efficient public housing that not only reduces emissions but makes life cheaper for everyday people.
What are the implications of this study for Aotearoa, especially considering our proximity to the Southern Ocean?
Well, across the Pacific, what we will be seeing is faster rising sea levels. We're already seeing how communities in the South Island, like in Dunedin, for example, in South Dunedin, already having to very rapidly adapt to the realities that whole townships could be underwater should we not act quickly. But this should be a wake-up call for our government that instead of investing more in fossil fuels and spouting climate denialist rhetoric, they actually need to invest in issues like clean energy, fast-speed electrified trains, and many other solutions that will tackle climate change.
Do you think that our government is likely to take these findings seriously enough?
Well, what is concerning is that the government has continuously denied the science behind climate change. And so my message is to the people that we do need a change of government to ensure that we actually have one that doesn't turn their back on the most recent evidence that shows that actually the Antarctic is melting at a faster rate than we thought, and this is largely driven by government decisions that prioritize fossil fuel corporates as opposed to the livelihoods of our communities.
These findings are coming shortly after the government's exit from the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance. What are the potential consequences for Aotearoa if the government continues its approach to the climate crisis in the face of warnings such as these?
Our government is already the laughingstock of the scientific community by investing in things that go completely against the needs of our communities. So, for example, the most recent opening of coal mining in Aotearoa will not yield the economic benefits that Shane Jones claims it will. And instead, we're missing out on investing in the very same things that not only lead to lower carbon emissions, but could make our lives cheaper. As I said, things like energy-efficient public housing, ensuring that we have interregional rail so that we're less car-dependent, and just ensuring that we actually look after our natural environments that end up soaking up a lot of that carbon.
Moving on to the next topic, last week the government allowed the terrorist designation given to the far-right Proud Boys group to expire. The Proud Boys were registered as a terrorist entity in 2022 under the previous Labour government, and the expiry of their designation effectively decriminalises the act of funding or openly supporting the group. What was the Green Party's reaction to the removal of the Proud Boys designation as a terrorist organisation?
Again, it really shows that the government doesn't take the violent threat of white supremacy seriously. The most deadly attack that we have had in our shores was led by white supremacists, and the Proud Boys spout the very same hateful rhetoric that many people who wish to cause harm in our communities do. But I think it goes beyond the terrorist label. It goes to the core that this is a government that has not done enough to, for example, de-radicalize white supremacists onshore and take the voices of Muslim, Jewish, and other religious minority communities seriously who are more at risk of white supremacist violence.
While there's no evidence of the group having chapters in the country, do you think that the decision not to renew their terrorist designation could embolden the members of other far-right groups in the country?
Absolutely, because it sends a message beyond people who belong or affiliate or support the Proud Boys. It sends a message that this is a government that does not take the threat to safety of white supremacist groups seriously, despite having evidence that it was white supremacy that caused the most violent attack that we have seen in our history, resulting in dozens of deaths. And so this is why we need a government that does enough to, for example, onshore have de-radicalization programs that takes inequality seriously and that takes the voices of groups most at risk from the violence of white supremacy seriously, which this government isn't doing.
Do you think that the government has softened their stance on far-right groups and activities throughout their term?
They not only have softened their views, they're cozying up to those very same groups. And Christopher Luxon seems to be comfortable having coalition parties attached to him that literally affiliate with people who spout white supremacist violent rhetoric that puts people's lives at risk. And so this is not just the softening, it's a literal handing off the silver plate to those very same groups by nature of having some of our most powerful political leaders affiliating with people who support white supremacist rhetoric.
On to our last topic, Finance Minister Nicola Willis has recently confirmed a number of changes to Family Boost, which she said would help families with the cost of living crisis. Among the changes were an increase in Family Boost rebates on early childhood education fees and an increase in the income threshold of families eligible for the scheme. What was the Green Party's reaction to the government's recent Family Boost changes, particularly the changes to rebates on ECE fees?
So $15 a week is too little, too late. And the reality is that what we need is a government that addresses the reality that our ECE sector, which is supposed to deliver really important care and support for some of our youngest at some of the most critical years, is being treated as a for-profit business as opposed to a core public good. So we don't think these changes are good enough, and this is why the Greens and our Green Budget championed taking the early childhood education sector into public ownership so that people can have free ECE and our ECE workers can be adequately resourced and supported, because right now the ECE sector and the workers working in that sector are in crisis.
What are some of the persisting issues with Family Boost and why the system might still be too complex for families trying to access support?
Most people are finding it hard to navigate their entitlements and to have the information required to be able to access them. And the compounding issue as well is that it's now not just an issue of cost barriers to access ECE, but it is the uncertainty that due to the deregulation of the ECE sector and continuing to drive it as a for-profit business, that our children's safety is now being compromised. And so we then have a double compounding issue of cost barriers made worse by an inaccessible family boost payment on top of less safe conditions and ECE placements.
Beyond the rebate system, what are some of the other funding issues in the ECE sector and what impacts are they having on families?
So we know that despite pouring billions into the ECE sector, the funding doesn't necessarily go directly to the children. Some of those companies are still making huge profits. And what this has led to, on top of the government's deregulation, has been, for example, the funding not going to support good wages for the workers in ECE places, and not having, for example, even enough staff to ensure that they can monitor the children's well-being at the recommended level. And so this is why we think that the for-profit kind of corporate model isn't working, and we need to instead bring it into public ownership and fund it as such so that people can have certainty that the money that goes into ECE is directly going into the children's and workers' well-being.
And how would the Green Party reform both Family Boost and the wider ECE system to make it fairer and more accessible?
So as we have outlined in our Green Budget, we have a fully costed plan to bring ECE into public ownership and adequately resource it. In terms of Family Boost, by making ECE free and into public ownership, the subsidies won't be needed. But we also have proposed reforms to income support systems so that we have something that is called a universal child payment. And the idea is that this would be expanding the Working for Families package so that then families with young children have the support that they need so that those critical first years basically deliver the best outcomes for the child, but then lead into, you know, really strong benefits later on in life.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March speaking to us about the recent study showing the increased speed of Antarctic ice melt, the removal of the Proud Boys designation as a terrorist group, and the government's recent Family Boost announcement.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
It's time to get action with Action Station Aotearoa, the segment where we chat with the people campaigning for a fairer future.
The Southerner was a passenger express train in the South Island running between Christchurch and Invercargill from 1970 to 2002. The train was eventually closed due to a decline in passenger numbers and subsidies, although it was briefly revived in May this year for 4 days as part of a tourist experience. Recently, a group of campaigners from Save Our Trains launched a petition calling on the government to restore the Southerner train route as a more accessible form of travel for South Islanders. Wednesday Wire host Otto spoke with Dave McPherson from Save Our Train Southern to discuss his petition and why the Southerner should be restored.
So to begin, can you tell us about your petition and what your calls are?
The petition's trying to get passenger rail back in the South Island, basically, and the vehicle we're using that, to use a bit of a pun there, is actually trying to get back the old train that we used to have running, not necessarily the old vehicle itself, but running along the line between Christchurch, the main railway line, Christchurch, Dunedin, Invercargill, and all the towns in between. There's about at least 8 stops major towns along that route. We want service by passenger rail. Now, they're getting passenger rail in the North Island in different parts, not everywhere yet, but we've got zero, absolutely big fat zero in the South Island. So we're trying to make sure that we get a share of that resource and we give people down here an option for more sustainable travel, more affordable travel, safer type of travel.
Can you give us some background around the Southerner train and why it was so important for South Islanders when it was active?
Sure, good question. The Southerner ran until 2002, from about the 1960s. Before that, there were different trains not running the whole length in one hit, but in the 1960s, they got a train going that ran the whole length and was a daytime train. There were also sometimes some nighttime trains and other things like that, but they completely canned everything from the 1970s onwards and eventually 2002 for the Southerner itself. But what it did was it connected towns and cities down the east coast of the South Island that had no air links in many cases, often not very suitable coach links, and certainly people who didn't have vehicles, didn't have their own cars and things like that. It provided, we call, interregional transport that wasn't available to many people or affordable, even if it was available. So it's a form of connection between the South Island towns. 750,000 people, about three quarters of the population of the South Island, live along that route. So that's who we're talking about connecting. And it's, you know, it's things like going to see your grandparents in Invercargill when you live in Timaru, or if you're at uni in Dunedin, going back to visit the parents over the holidays. The only place you can get airfares that actually work in the South Island between Christchurch and Dunedin, and they're often hideously expensive, things like $420 for a one-hour flight on a propeller plane. But there, you know, it's just not affordable for people. And a lot of disabled people as well, have trouble using planes and coaches. They, for instance, if you're got in a wheelchair or a walker, you can't use a coach. Not that there's that many of them, maybe twice a day, because you can't climb up the stairs and the drivers aren't allowed to help you. Whereas trains, once you get onto the platform, are pretty much level with the platform, the floors of the trains, things like that, much more comfortable. And you can also work in trains, which you can't in the others. Say you're a businessman in Dunedin going up to Christchurch for a meeting, you can work on your laptop, plug it in to get Wi-Fi and a recharge on the way up. And all of those things are available in trains in the North Island. They're part of the public transport system. So we're not talking about tourist trains. We're talking about, you know, that are quite high priced and run very irregularly. We're talking about a regular scheduled route that's supported by the public transport system in Aotearoa, New Zealand. And that's not available at the moment here in the South Island, and it is partly in the North Island.
Are there any economic benefits that could also come from restoring the Southerner train?
Another good question, Otto. When you have a railway station that's regularly functioning, business people and others will look at building things like cafes, various other retail shops in service centres around that. And we've actually spoken, for instance, to the owner of the old Invercargill station where the train would still stop. It's no longer owned by Kiwi Rail. And it's a two-storey building with offices above. He's got a struggling cafe down the bottom and he wants to open up more of the unused area down the bottom. So it becomes a bit of a retail complex built around the rail service that could be provided there and used to be. Same in Timaru, actually, with the railway station. It would actually cause people to gravitate towards that and build some business around that. We've seen cases overseas where when they've built new railway stations, sometimes even underground, they've built retail and residential complexes above them. Now, I think we're way off probably that happening in most of the South Island, possibly in Christchurch, but it would certainly generate more economic activity. Even Dunedin, with a historical railway station building at the station. They've renovated the station. It looks beautiful, but there aren't any trains except for a couple of tourist trains going through there. And there's a business and an art gallery in there, but they struggle because people don't go down there on a regular basis. So all of those things would get boosted. You know, the $8 million that Dunedin City Council spent on Dunedin Railway Station would generate a lot more value in its own right if it could have some trains going through there, people going through there, people waiting for trains, people waiting to pick up family and whānau from their trains, all that sort of stuff.
Has support for the Southerner Trains reactivation increased recently amongst South Islanders?
Well, I think it's been there for a long time, to be honest, but what we've done is sort of motivated them to actually make an expression of that. We've got over 12,500 people signed the petition in just a month. We only had a small group based in Dunedin beforehand. Now our group's spreading and we've got people from Christchurch down to Invercargill that have joined in to help. And what they've found, and I've done this myself, being out on the streets in the South Island here, that 90% of the people you ask to sign the petition to calling for the Southerner to be brought back, there's stories about how they or their family used to use the train, and it's actually been a relatively easy thing because that support's already there. So what I think is you're seeing the manifestation of the support more now than it has been for a while, but I think it's been there for a long time. And it's not just oldies like that. We were down at Otago University about 2 or 3 weeks back collecting signatures right through a lunchtime, and we were rushed off our feet. We had two people there. We could have had about 5 or 6 people there, and all of us could have been busy. Once people knew what it was about, they didn't maybe remember the Southerner themselves. Some of them weren't born before when the Southerner finished in 2002. But when we talked about passenger rail and which centres it would serve, they were right into it, just like the older people.
And have you gotten any feedback from either the central government or local councils about the petition?
Oh, well, from local councils, a lot of nice words. We're trying to get some action going out of them. What we have had from the regional councils in both Canterbury and Otago is they put statements into their bureaucratic plans, if you look, transport plans, saying that they'll investigate passenger rail for the future. So they haven't ruled it out like they used to or ignored it. They've said they'll look at it, but we need to do more work to motivate a bit more there. As far as the central government goes, we've got work to do yet, but there were 3 MPs there, including a government minister, receiving our petition last Friday in Dunedin at the Dunedin Railway Station, and they were supportive, and they're going to be raising it at committee meetings up in Parliament. It's not going to be a quick process to do that, but that is the start of what's needed. We need it to become a political issue, and we need our political representatives to start raising that. And these ones from 3 different parties, you know, both opposition and government, were there supporting us in receiving the petition and are going to take up the issue in Wellington.
That was Dave McPherson from Save Our Train Southern talking to us about a petition of his calling on the Southerner train line to be restored. If you're interested in signing this petition, you can find it on our.actionstation.org.nz under the name Restore the Southerner Train.
That was Get Action with Action Station Aotearoa.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the B.
Moisturizer, the bold 2nd album from Wet Leg, is out now. Moisturizer is fun, freaky and fabulous. An unbridled display of the live muscle Wet Leg have built up over a few years of non-stop touring. Punchier, prettier and more perverted. Moisturizer is an album of manic love songs and well-timed kiss-offs. Delivered by a clan of the UK's most beloved oddballs. Moisturizer by Wet Leg. Available wherever you get your music.
Ah! Guys! He finally asked me out! He says he knows a spot?
It better not be ice cream at Mission Bay.
I hope it's not under the Harbour Bridge.
Oh no! What if you have to walk up Mount Eden?
He better not think Minnehaha is original.
Oh, thank God! It's the beer spot! I can try the new local brews.
The 95 BFM Drive Show. A 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jive and jams. 4 to 7pm every weekday, only on 95 BFM.
Thanks to the Beer Spot, your tappy place. shiny new web series featuring local artists performing two of their own songs and one Kiwi cover.
Hosted by legend Tuva'a Clifton, Season 1 features Phoebe Rings, Soft Bait, Emily Bateman, Jim Nothing, Babe Martin, and Eliza.
B-Sides! New episode dropping every second Wednesday. Watch it now on the 95BFM YouTube channel.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. That was No Joy by The Beths. Let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text it on 5395.
The Wire.
I don't know, and frankly the whole thing gives me the heebie-jeebies.
The Wire.
For the first time in its history, staff at the government drug-buying agency, Pharmac, are going on strike. The action will happen this week after health economists, Māori health experts and medical practitioners, who are members of the New Zealand Public Service Association, received what was described as an unacceptable pay offer and a clawback of conditions. Pharmac is responsible for deciding which medicines and medical devices are publicly funded in New Zealand, an important part of the country's healthcare system. To talk about the details surrounding the first ever strike, I spoke with Public Service Association's National Secretary, Fleur Fitzsimons.
Given that this is the first ever strike at Pharmac, can you explain how we got to this point?
Yeah, it is really significant that it's the first strike at Pharmac. Pharmac is a very critical government agency. It makes sure that New Zealanders get access to life-saving medicines, and we know that the people who work there are really committed to their work, and they don't get paid ridiculously high salaries. They get paid very modest salaries, and many of them have been there for many years. So really this strike is about saying that we need to see improvements to their conditions. We need to see a pay offer that respects them and their families and the cost of living increases that they've faced, but also respects the importance of their work in New Zealand's public health system. And we're a long way from that at this stage.
And could you explain what the key issues that these members are striking over?
Yeah, it's really a strike which comes down to a response to the employer trying to reduce the terms and conditions of employment. And we have an collective agreement between the PSA and Pharmac. It has a whole range of entitlements that really reflect things like service. So if you've been at Pharmac for a period of time, you get access to what's called step pay progression. So your pay increases step by step over time. There's also redundancy payments available in that collective agreement and a range of entitlements that really exist to ensure that the health and safety of those workers is paramount and that their working conditions are fair and reasonable. And what we're seeing from Pharmac is an approach to this bargaining which attempts to reduce those terms and conditions of employment. So they want to get rid of the service eligibility for step-based pay progression to some degree. They want to limit and restrict the availability of redundancy payments only to permanent staff. But also there is a pay offer which is only 0.2%. And we all know that our costs have gone up by much more than 0.2%. So really what Pharmac are trying to do is make these workers go backwards and make it harder for them and their families to get by. And they're drawing a line in the sand and saying that's not good enough. And that's really the background to why the strike's occurring.
You mentioned an extensive clawback of conditions. Could you explain what Pharmac proposed to change?
Yeah, so they're really looking to take conditions backwards. So it's a reduction in their conditions of work. And that's particularly around the nature of the way the step-based pay increases work. They've also got the suggestion that people should buy out their step-based increase. So really corrupting the pay system that exists to recognise that over time, people get more confident, they get more experience, they develop more skills, and they get their pay increasing as a result. They're trying to buy out or get rid of those progression steps with a one-off payment. And really it is just an attempt to reduce the terms and conditions that apply to Pharmac workers. And if we were to agree to something like this over time, the conditions would get worse and worse. And actually what we want to see is improved terms and conditions for workers at Pharmac and all over New Zealand, because we know as a country we have a low wage culture and a low wage problem. We also have a long working hours issue. So we're not really looking to reduce the terms and conditions that apply to workers. What workers in New Zealand, and including those at Pharmac, need to see is better terms and conditions of employment.
Something else you mentioned was that Pharmac workers are being asked to do more with less. Could you elaborate on this?
Yeah, it's something that we're seeing all across the public sector. We are seeing vacancies not being filled. We are seeing job descriptions and expectations on workers increasing. They are being asked to pick up on the work of people who haven't been replaced or jobs that have been merged. And we're really seeing workloads becoming unmanageable at the same time as government expectations of these agencies is increasing. So we're not seeing the government saying, oh, we'll impose these cuts. Also, we expect you to do less. That's just not the reality of what public sector workers are seeing. And it's really not going to work. It is not a recipe for effective, high-quality public services, and nor is it a recipe for harmonious industrial relations, because workers see through it. Constantly being asked to deliver more with less will not work, and it will cause public services to suffer, it will cause burnout, and it will cause industrial action like we're seeing here at Pharmac.
As you alluded to earlier, Pharmac's pay offer was 0.2%. Can you go into how this pay offer was received by members?
Well, it's an offensive pay offer. It's barely a pay offer. 0.2% is on very modest wages is really not going to help these workers with the cost of living increases that they and their families are experiencing. So it was never a pay offer that was going to be well received across the table or by these workers. And actually, that's what Pharmac needs to reflect on. This approach is not going to settle this dispute. We need to see a pay offer which is humane and which recognises that people's cost of living is increasing and they will go backwards if we accept pay offers like this in the future.
The parties are attending mediation on the 16th and 17th of July. What do you hope comes out of this?
We're really hopeful that Pharmac will come to that mediation with an approval and an approach to settling this dispute. They will need to walk away from their attempted clawbacks in the conditions, and they will need to bring a pay offer which reflects the cost of living increases the workers and their families are experiencing, and also the value of the work that these people do, because it's absolutely critical in our health system, and we want it recognised in a pay offer that is respectful and takes into account the cost of living that it increases that our members are facing. And there is an opportunity for Pharmac to settle this dispute at mediation, and we really hope they'll take it.
Thanks, Fleur. That was my final question, but was there anything else that you wanted to add?
Just that we've had a really strong outpouring of support from other health workers for these Pharmac workers. Everyone is doing it tough in health. The government has lost control of health, and New Zealanders know it. And this will be just the beginning of strike action in our health sector if the government doesn't start funding it properly and recognising the importance of these workers and the work that they do.
And that was the PSA's Fleur Fitzsimons on the first ever strike at Pharmac. Both parties are attending mediation on the 16th and 17th of July.
Oh yeah, let's rock and roll, man.
The Wire.
At a recent summit in Paris, French President Emmanuel Macron proposed a number of options for New Caledonia's potential statehood following island-wide unrest last year over voting reforms that led to 14 deaths. One of the options proposed by Macron involved granting New Caledonia associated statehood status, where the island would be a largely self-governing while still being linked to the French state. Otto spoke with Gordon Nano, co-head of Maori and Pacific Studies at the University of Auckland, about Macron's proposal to grant New Caledonia associated state status and what this would mean for the island's indigenous Kanak population, who have largely been seeking independence from France.
French President Emmanuel Macron recently announced a number of options for New Caledonia's future political status at a conference in Paris that happened earlier this week. Would you be able to tell us about the different options that were proposed and how they'd affect the parties involved?
With my little understanding of the situation, I think there are two main positions in New Caledonia. One is taken by the Kanaks, which is full independence, full political independence. And I think the other position is by the other group that wants to maintain the status quo, you know, to remain part of France, New Caledonia being a part of France. So I think those are the two major positions. And then I'm hearing that there's a third position being proposed, where I think a mention of associate status is being mentioned. And I think that's a position by the French state. So those are the three positions, if I understand it correctly.
Would you be able to tell us a bit about the associated statehood position and how that is different from New Caledonia's current status?
At the moment, New Caledonia is regarded a territory, so it is a good way of putting it, maybe a colony in the Pacific. So there are existing examples of associate states that we are familiar with in the Pacific. And one is, I think, well known to New Zealanders, which is the association between Cook Islands, Niue, and New Zealand, where I think foreign affairs and defense is left to the New Zealand government, but basically citizens, if you like, of New Zealand. So that's one example, model that we have in the Pacific. And there is also this model of association between the Federated States of Micronesia Marshall Islands and Palau, I think, if I remember correctly, with the United States of America. That association is under the Compact of Free Association, or they are called the Compact States. And again, they are independent, but parts of their governing roles, the functions are taken over by the United States, like defense, foreign affairs. And in return for the use of, you know, some of their islands for strategic military purposes. So these are the ones that we are familiar with in the Pacific, association between Pacific states or Pacific islands and the U.S. and the existing one between New Zealand and Cook Islands, for instance. So I think there are models that we can relate to when they mentioned the associated states kind of model.
So how would France be involved in New Caledonia as an associated state?
Yeah, again, if we take the models that we are familiar with, then I think the idea is the French state plays some functions, but it gives more autonomy, more functions to the new entity or the new state of New Caledonia. So similar to what you have between New Zealand and the Cook Islands, I guess.
And on the ground, how do New Caledonia's indigenous Kanak people feel about the idea of associated statehood?
From historical documents and from what they have been pushing for over the years, I think they are more interested in getting total independence or being an independent country of New Caledonia. But having said that, I think the good thing is that they are sitting there, they're together with all the different parties, at least they're sitting together and determining what is the best way forward for New Caledonia.
But going off of that, do you think that associated statehood could possibly lead to full independence in the future?
It depends very much on the legal instruments that they come up with. That is, assuming they come up with some kind of agreement after the current meetings. And if there is provision in that instrument that maybe over the certain number of years, there will be a review if New Caledonia wants to be, you know, a totally independent state. But again, that is on the table. So I think they're discussing those possibilities at the moment. And whether they'll be able to gain full statehood in the long run, I think that's what they're working on at the moment. And I'm glad they're working on them, because the future will depend very much on how the people of New Caledonia feel about the opportunities that are before them.
And how do you feel the indigenous Kanak people will be directly impacted by the option of associated statehood?
I think their ultimate aim over the years has been to gain full autonomy. But again, these are options that are put forward in the current meetings. And let's hope that they come up with something feasible for all parties involved and for the good of New Caledonia's future.
All right, well, I think that's everything from me, but is there anything else you'd like to add before we finish the interview?
Just to reiterate the point that I think it's really good to see that discussion, how long it takes or what format it takes after the discussions is entirely up to the people of New Caledonia and, of course, in discussion with the French state. But I think for me, seeing them engaging in the discussion and talking about possibilities for the future is already progress from my point of view.
That was co-head of Māori and Pacific Studies at the University of Auckland, Gordon Nano, speaking to us about the proposal to grant New Caledonia associated state status.
The Wire.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. That song was I Try to Talk to You by Hercules and Love Affair, and before that was Mountain at My Gates by Foals.
That's probably slightly off topic. What was the question again?
The Wire.
Dementia, or mate wareware, is a devastating and life-changing condition that affects 70,000 New Zealanders today. There have been calls to support rural Māori communities with members who have the condition, as Māori are more likely to experience mate wareware than other groups in the country. A kaupapa has been launched by the University of Auckland's Dr. Makarena Dudley and Sir Richard Fowle to better provide rural Māori communities with better education, guidance and support. On Monday, producer Samantha spoke to Dudley, who is the Deputy Director Māori at the Centre of Brain Research, Te Huinga Hinengaro, about the research and what support is needed for these communities.
Why are services for those suffering with mate wareware slash dementia so difficult to get in rural communities?
Can I first make the point that dementia or mate wareware is not a disease? The reason why we say that is because we don't actually know the cause of it. We don't know the etiology of dementia. And the different types of dementia have different pathways and therefore different causation. So what we do is we call it a condition. I refer to it as a condition. Some people refer to it as a syndrome, which is a syndrome is it can be a number of different symptoms that are similar in terms of their presentation. There are fewer dementia services, mate wareware services in country areas. So people have to travel into the town, into the city, in order to access what information and what services there are available, which, by the way, are pretty scarce on the ground for everybody. And, you know, there is not a lot of investment at government level that has been made in the area of dementia, mate wareware. And so the services that are there, which are mainly from a Western perspective, are not all that great. It's not there to the extent that it should be. And so, obviously, if you're Māori, there is even less available for Māori. And the more further out you live from urban areas, the more difficult to access what is available. So, and you know, I mean, as I said, it just comes down to logistics often, and many rural people living in rural areas are not able to, you know, connect to the internet. So there is a lot of information available on the internet, albeit most of it is in a Western kind of a framework, but not all people living in rural areas can access that kind of information easily. And so it's purely a logistic kind of a issue. And in the more remote areas, we're finding that there are fewer people who are specialising, if you like, who are working in this area of mate wareware to be able to provide, you know, the type of service that is required by people living in that area.
What kind of medical services are the average rural marae even able to provide on their own? For dementia specifically?
Oh, I mean, I don't think there's any marae that provides any medical service for mate wareware. There are local non-government organisations, health organisations. They're in some remote areas. We have, like, for example, there's one out at Pauranga, out at Broadwood, which is reasonably remote. And so there is a medical centre there. Some of them that I do have medical centres attached to them. A lot of them don't. So it kind of varies across the country. And the extent to which services for dementia, mate wareware are provided also fluctuates a lot depending on, you know, from place to place. So there's a vast array of different levels of services that are provided. But by and large, I would think that the services that are provided are pretty limited. We don't really have a huge workforce in terms of, you know, people working in this area. So that in itself is difficult, makes it difficult to provide the service if you don't have the workforce.
What health outcomes are we seeing for Māori with mate wareware?
We're actually conducting a Māori prevalence study nationwide in Aotearoa right now. And so we don't know the exact extent to what that it exists out there in the community. We have done some small studies in some pockets around Aotearoa, one out of Middlemore Hospital, and that suggests that Māori are more likely to suffer from mate wareware and more likely to suffer from it at an earlier age. So that's what the little evidence we have now suggests, but this current prevalence study will give us much more firmer and valid data around the condition and to what extent it does exist in the community.
Has the government pushed for better outcomes for Māori in rural communities? Prevention of mate wareware or being able to push back against it once it's started to progress?
Look, I'm not aware of anything in particular being targeted toward people living in rural areas. I think that most of the services that do exist are primarily focused on providing, you know, something to the people in the cities, in the urban areas. So To my knowledge, this is not extended beyond that, unless, although we do have places like Alzheimer's New Zealand, Kerikeri, who do come out to Kaitaia, and I know they do work out here, talking to the community out here. But in terms of them going into the more remote country areas, I'm not quite sure to what extent that happens. Not a lot, I don't think, although I think they certainly do try their best with the resources that they have, because, you know, the government is not, as I think I might have mentioned earlier, is not invested a lot in this area. So our dementia services, you know, are being run on soft money and philanthropic donations. So, yeah, they're not well funded, and I think they do a good job considering, you know, that situation that they're in. And I think, you know, I think the government needs to invest more in this area, because it appears, well, it's given that the fact that we are living longer now, there are downside of that is there are going to be more people who are going to be suffering from age-related conditions such as mati wariwari. So it would make sense, you would think, to, you know, to invest in this future onslaught. So put the ambulance at the top of the cliff, if you like, rather than wait till it gets here. But we do have a dementia mati wariwari action plan, where the which has been recommended by the World Health Organization, that all countries should have a dementia action plan. And so we do have one which expires this year, in fact. And so work has been done on a new action plan, looking at what needs to be done in the next 5 years in order to, you know, to combat this condition that we're going to be facing. And that is, you know, the actions that are recommended in the action plan are based on evidence that we have today.
How do rural Māori communities with people dealing with mate wareware find the help they need currently?
Well, I mean, I hate to be pessimistic, but certainly I've heard so many stories where people aren't coping that well, and that people are desperate to access information so that they know what to do. But, you know, more and more I hear stories where they don't know what to do. They don't know where to turn to. Whānau don't know where to turn to. You know, so in some cases, whānau come together. They pool their resources in order to look after the loved one with mate wariwari. And this might mean one of them does some research online to find out, you know, what can be done in order to help this person and this whānau on their journey. But there are a lot of caregivers who are doing this alone. And it's one of the worst conditions, I suppose, that you could be a caregiver for. So it's really very, very difficult for some caregivers, particularly if they're alone. And often that's often the case. There's just, you know, the whole task of looking after that person is put upon one member of the whānau. So they are struggling. They really are. They're just, you know, quite desperate. That's why I think these caregiver support programs are incredibly important. That's something that everybody can run out in these rural areas. It's just a matter of getting together and sharing stories and getting support from each other people who are going through it or have gone through it, and you can learn from them. And it's also important to that they access the Mati Wariwari app, which we developed. So I've heard a number of people say to me from rural areas that the accessing the app was a lifesaver to them. It helped them get through, you know, the job of looking after the loved one. But by and large, it's a pretty grim story, I'm sad to say. And, you know, it's such a shame, because it's more than a shame, it's a crime, because to a large extent, this condition of mati wariwari dementia is preventable. There are, you know, identified risk factors, which really about making lifestyle changes that can dramatically lower the risk of the onset of mati wariwari dementia or slow down the progress of it by up to 40%. But if people don't know this, people don't know about these risk factors. And so that, to me, is a crime. And so that's one of the things that I do when we go and visit Marais, to let them know about these risk factors, empower people with this knowledge so that they can go away and do something and make a difference, you know, in their whānau, in their children, in their grandchildren, their tamariki mokapuna, because it starts early in life. And it's really, you know, to ward off the onset of mati wariwari, you need to start early in life. And there are a number of risk factors, but basically it's about living a healthy life, and that will dramatically reduce the risk of getting mati wariwari.
What can be done to improve the care received by those in need?
The more people that are involved in the care, the better. I think, you know, when the whole responsibility is left to one person, that is too much. But that's often the case, sadly. So to share the load, that amongst family, amongst whānau, that would be wonderful. Māori are less likely to have their loved one placed in residential care. So what happens is that, one person in the whānau will look after somebody in the whānau will look after the loved one. They might have to leave work. So there's that financial burden placed upon whānau who are often in suffering or not managing very well economically anyway. So if, there's one caregiver in there who has to give up work to come home and look after their loved one, then that's an extra financial burden. And so unpaid caregiving is a huge problem, I think. And, because we don't place our loved ones in. But, ideally, it would be great to have local in the local health provider have a specialist team or a specialist person, even just one person who is as I said, a specialist and expert in Māori Wairere dementia and is able to assist family living within that area. There is a lot of for people living in rural areas, if they are able to, there is a lot of information online. And I think it's particularly important to access information about dealing with challenging behaviours. Access information online. If you're a Māori whānau, you might particularly resonate with the Māori Wairere app, which is at www.māoriwairere.co.nz. You might find that more relevant to your situation. But and if you want to contact the Centre for Brain Research at the University of Auckland, we would be happy to come to your marae and present and talk about Māori Wairere, talk about heart health and how that is related to brain health, which is really useful to know because a lot of people don't realise that. So just let us know.
That was the University of Auckland's Dr. Makarena Dudley on a new kaupapa to support rural Māori communities with members who have mate wareware or dementia.
That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today. The Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, Save Our Train Southern's Dave McPherson, the University of Auckland's Gordon Nano and Makarena Dudley, and the Public Service Association's Fleur Fitzsimmons. Nei ra hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakaronga ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.